chance of rain. For Thursday, showers are likely, highs 59 to 67. More news is next on KAXE.
Most people have to figure out, do they have savings? Do they have friends and family that can help them? It can be a very stressful situation.
Facing the Justice Department in court has steep financial and emotional costs, even if you win.
For Tuesday, October 14th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Alyssa Nadworny.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The government shutdown is affecting federal workers far beyond D.C.
One Utah city has a large IRS workforce, and the missing paychecks are already hitting hard.
Something was in the air, and people were hesitant to come and spend or, you know, treat themselves to lunch.
Plus, the Maine governor has announced she's running to unseat Senator Susan Collins.
And a new thriller co-authored by Harlan Coben and the actress Reese Witherspoon.
Maggie was, for me, a character as vivid and real as any character I've ever played in a movie.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Israel says it opened fire in Gaza, even as a ceasefire deal remains in place between Israel and Hamas. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports.
The Israeli military said its troops opened fire on, quote, several suspects. It said these individuals were crossing the yellow line that marks the boundary Israeli troops have pulled back to in the first phase of the U.S.-brokered peace plan for Gaza. The military asked Gaza residents not to approach troops in this area and said those individuals were violating the ceasefire agreement. Hamas, in a statement, said it was Israel who violated the truce and that a number of Gaza residents were killed as a result. Gaza's local health authority said six Palestinians have been killed in two separate events in the Strip. Overall, though, for now, the ceasefire is broadly still holding. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News.
Hundreds of workers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory are getting laid off today. About 11% of the staff will be affected. As NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, these layoffs are not related to the government shutdown.
The Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California is owned by NASA and managed by Caltech. It's been responsible for high-profile robotic space missions like the Voyager probes and Mars rovers. It operates the deep space network used to communicate with faraway spacecraft and is currently working on missions like a robotic probe that will go to an icy moon of Jupiter, Europa. The head of the lab, Dave Gallagher, says the layoffs are part of a reorganization that began in July, shortly after he became the director. Positions are being eliminated across technical, business, and support areas. Approximately 550 people will lose their jobs. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
The Federal Reserve has another interest rate decision to make in a couple of weeks. As NPR's Scott Horsley reports, it may have to do so with limited information.
Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell told a gathering of business economists today that the economic outlook doesn't appear to have changed much since he and his colleagues voted to cut interest rates by a quarter percentage point last month. The job market's a little softer, inflation's a little higher. Powell notes some key economic reports are being delayed, however, by the government shutdown.
We'll start to miss that data, and particularly the October data. If this goes on for a while, they won't be collecting it, and it could become more challenging.
This is the week when government number crunchers would ordinarily be tallying the number of new jobs added, as well as the number of people who are unemployed. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's former employer, Fox News, is joining nearly all news organizations, including NPR, saying its reporters won't sign pledges to report only what the Pentagon has authorized. So far, only the conservative One America News Network says it will follow the rules. From Washington, this is NPR News. Madagascar President Ange Rajoelina has been toppled in a military coup that capped weeks of youth-led protests. The country's parliament voted to impeach him today, and he fled the country. Madagascar's armed forces are forming a council of military and police officers to appoint a new prime minister. Rajoelina's office condemned the military announcement as a serious breach of the rule of law. The U.S. and China have introduced new fees on each other's ships each time they dock at port. The move comes as trade tensions between the two economic superpowers increases. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
President Trump followed through on his threat earlier this year to slap fees on any Chinese-owned or operated ship docking at an American port. It's part of a broader effort to turn the U.S. into a great shipbuilding nation again. China currently produces more than half the world's vessels. The U.S. about 1%. But now China has followed suit, saying it will slap special charges on any U.S.-owned, operated, flagged, or built American vessel. Analysts say the moves could cost larger shipping companies hundreds of millions of dollars and risk upending global supply chains and raising prices. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Instagram says it will restrict teenagers to only see PG-13 content, and they won't be able to change their settings without a parent's permission. The company is also adding an even stricter setting that parents can set up for their children. Parent company Meta promises it won't show inappropriate content to teens, like posts about self-harm, eating disorders, or suicide. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
6 minutes after 5 o'clock, thank you for listening to People Powered KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Lakes Area United Way has their 25th annual chili cook-off tomorrow from 11 to 1 at the Northern Pacific Center in Brainerd. Your entry fee will allow you to sample a variety of chilies plus dessert. And there is a waffle brunch fundraiser for a new dog park in Deer River this Sunday, 9 to 1 at the Deer River Vets Club. Tickets available at the door or in advance at the Chocolate Dog.
It's Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Alyssa Nadworny. This year, President Trump has been calling on the Justice Department to prosecute his perceived enemies. And the DOJ seems to be following through. It secured indictments against former FBI Director Jim Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James in just the last few weeks alone. The White House has been signaling more cases may be on the way, so we wanted to ask our justice correspondent, Carrie Johnson, about the cost of mounting a criminal defense. Hi, Carrie.
Hi there.
So first off, how much does a good lawyer cost in this situation?
Lawyers tell me there's no golden rule here, but there are a bunch of factors to consider: what charges a person faces, where they are in the country. Defense lawyers will have to review transcripts, FBI files, and get ready to cross-examine witnesses. Lisa Wayne is executive director of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. She's done 150 trials during her career.
Most people have to figure out of pocket and figure out, do they have the savings? Do they have friends and family that can help them? Do they take mortgages on their homes? It can be a very stressful situation for most individuals.
I spoke with three other veteran criminal lawyers who said for these kinds of high-profile cases, it could cost $1 million to $5 million at a small firm and much more at a big law firm where some partners charge $2,500 an hour. Those kind of bills could reach $25 million or more.
Wow, that is a lot of money. Do people facing these kinds of charges have other options?
Sometimes. The former FBI director Jim Comey is being represented by his old friend, a former prosecutor called Patrick Fitzgerald. At his old law firm, Skadden, Fitzgerald might have commanded more than $2,000 an hour, but he's retired now, working for himself, and can set his own rates or even donate his time. Then there's California Democratic Senator Adam Schiff. Schiff is a longtime Trump critic who helped investigate President Trump during his first term in office. Now Schiff is under federal investigation. Here's President Trump talking about that recently at the White House.
Looks like Adam Schiff really did a bad thing. They have them. Now, let's see what happens.
The issue here is that Schiff has homes in both California and Maryland, closer to the Senate. Schiff says he accurately filled out the paperwork and consulted with lawyers and mortgage companies. His attorney, Preet Bharara, a prominent former prosecutor in New York, says these allegations are false, stale, and long debunked. Even so, Schiff has created a legal defense fund to help pay his bills. A White House spokeswoman said the DOJ is on the right track. She says the Trump administration will continue to deliver the truth to the American people while restoring integrity and accountability to the justice system.
Carrie, speaking of justice, who is doing the investigating at the Justice Department right now? And what do we know about their approach?
The key figure is Ed Martin. He is a lawyer from Missouri who has had more experience in politics than in the courtroom. He could not get confirmed by the Senate to be the U.S. attorney in Washington, in part because of his support for the people who rioted at the Capitol in 2021. Instead, he got a different job in charge of the weaponization working group at DOJ. Here's what Martin said as he started that job.
There are some really bad actors, some people that did some really bad things to the American people. And if they can be charged, we'll charge them. But if they can't be charged, we will name them. And in a culture that respects shame, they should be people that are shamed.
That is not the way the DOJ policy has worked in the past. Prosecutors are not supposed to be bad-mouthing people. They can't charge with crimes. But that seems to be the way this DOJ and the White House are approaching Trump's perceived enemies this year.
So we've been talking about dollars and cents of someone's defense, but what about other costs with being charged with a crime?
The emotional pressure on people in these situations can be really intense, not just a defendant, but also his or her entire family. They're in the spotlight, sometimes having to sit there and take it while people say terrible things about you. And then even if someone wins an acquittal, they've really been through the ringer. Think about D.C. lawyer Michael Sussman. He was investigated by a special counsel in connection with his work for Hillary Clinton's campaign. A jury in D.C. found him not guilty of making a false statement to the FBI after 2 weeks of trial. Here he is outside the courthouse after he won in 2022.
Despite being falsely accused, I'm relieved that justice ultimately prevailed in my case. As you can imagine, this has been a difficult year for my family and me. But right now, we are just grateful for the love and support of so many during this ordeal.
Back in the 1980s, the former labor secretary under President Reagan faced fraud charges, but he was acquitted by a jury. He famously said then, "Which office do I go to get my reputation back?"
That was NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Thanks, Carrie.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Bowman, NPR's Pentagon correspondent, is handing in his press pass. Now, that does not mean he will stop doing the job. The Pentagon, under Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, is asking reporters to sign a new policy, a policy stating that they won't obtain or solicit any information the Pentagon hasn't authorized. News outlets across the ideological spectrum are refusing to sign this restrictive new policy, and Tom is here now. Hey there.
Hey, Mary Louise.
You have been covering the Pentagon a long time. I imagine you have been kicked out of worse places.
I have indeed.
Have you ever seen anything like this?
Never in 28 years of covering the Pentagon. Now, over the years, there have been some, of course, heated exchanges with officials. Most notably, you remember Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, who could be quite acerbic and push back against hard questions. But he never tried to restrict our access like this or curtail our efforts to get information. And, you know, other defense secretaries had a deep knowledge of the military or industry or Capitol Hill, and almost all of them thought it was important for the public to be informed of decisions, to come out frequently, you know, what was being done in the public's name with their money, and also, why are you sending their sons and daughters into harm's way? But Secretary Hegseth doesn't have that basis of knowledge, and he's been hit hard with stories about dysfunction in his office, disarray, telling senior officers he could have them polygraphed. So you wonder if this is, these embarrassing stories, is this kind of the root of all this effort to curtail our reporting? And Mary Louise, Secretary Hegseth defended the policy today, saying, quote, it's common sense stuff. And, quote, we're trying to make sure national security is respected and we're proud of the policy. It doesn't really explain it.
Although I keep turning over that phrase in my mind that you can't solicit information as a member of the Pentagon press corps. Isn't that the whole point of being a reporter?
Absolutely. And the policy says you cannot reach out to someone and ask for information, even unclassified information. And basically, you wait until the Pentagon releases information. That turns us into stenographers and not reporters. That basically means we just parrot what the government tells us, much like you would see in countries, authoritarian ones, where the government places sharp controls on the press. But of course, the founders didn't want that. Thomas Jefferson was no real fan of the press, but he realized it was important to democracy for a press to hold leaders accountable.
And just lay out the stakes here. We said you are handing in your Pentagon press pass, but you are not going to stop covering the beat. So what are we actually losing?
Well, you know, it'll hamper our ability to report, but it doesn't mean we're all just going to stop. Most reporters have developed good sources over the years. I did in Iraq and Afghanistan, both now on active duty and also retired. So some will still be talking with us, as well as sources in other government offices, even foreign embassies. I'm reaching out to them even more now because of this, you know, curtailing of our jobs. You know, Mary Louise, one Marine officer I spoke with told me a reporter was complaining about this new policy, and he basically said, listen, a Marine would forge ahead and find a way to still do the job. I just love that.
That is our Pentagon correspondent. I'm proud to call him my colleague, Tom Bowman. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks.
Books aren't always available for children everywhere in the U.S. One group in West Virginia wants to change that for preschoolers. As part of our series, Here to Help, West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Chris Schultz reports.
Even in our digital age, a good book can still a room full of young kids brimming with morning energy.
Pete the cat was walking down the street in his brand new white shoes.
Devin Chopra is a junior in high school, but today she's in a preschool classroom in Grafton, West Virginia. She's reading Pete the Cat.
Loved his white shoes so much, he sang this song. I love my white shoes.
I'm here because I really want to spread the love of reading.
Chopra has been volunteering with the Literary Society for 4 years, since she was in seventh grade. The group collects books and takes them to classrooms like this one for students to take home.
We've been bringing books through Appalachia, and this was the next in our stop.
Do you like presents?
Yeah! Yes.
The children get excited when she hands them their books. Ronnie Azuri created the Literary Society. The name is a play on her love of reading and tea. She came up with it in her home of Morgantown, West Virginia, about 5 years ago. That's when she learned about book deserts, places where books for children are difficult to get.
I was so sad to learn in middle school that so many children don't have that privilege of having a parent or caregiver read to them or have books at home. And so when I started, I really wanted to begin with donating Pete the Cat books because that was my favorite.
Since then, she created a nonprofit organization with thousands of volunteers that has donated over $1 million worth of new, best-selling picture books to over 91,000 preschool children. Volunteers like Chopra have helped the organization spread across the country. She says the Literary Society makes it easy for middle schoolers to join. For Chopra, starting early was key.
You can make a difference if you're a child because they're younger, because they're middle school, high school. They don't think that what they do is really, really going to make a difference. And to that, I say, look at the Literary Society because we're entirely youth-led.
The reward of volunteering to read to children and bring them their own books is clear to her.
It honestly means the world to me because specifically in this state, I always think if just one kid falls in love with reading and has the same passion that I had as a kid growing up, then it makes everything worth it.
The Literary Society already has high school chapters in all 50 states and is even encouraging kids 12 and younger to get involved. For NPR News, I'm Chris Schultz in Grafton, West Virginia.
In 2022, Ronnie Azuri received a Daily Point of Light Award, which honors a volunteer every day for their community service. For more stories of ordinary people who are exceptional volunteers, visit npr.org/heretohelp.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
There is more ahead from All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE. Good evening. It is 5:18. I'm Jennifer Barr. At 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And at 7, John Henningsgaard, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support for KAXE comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses, including cloud solutions, cybersecurity services, network management, and more, all with local customer service and support. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. And we thank the Grassroots Concert Series, presenting the Rowe Family Singers Friday, October 24th, 7 p.m. at the Livewell Nightclub and Coffee Bar, located in the Journey Church in Nisswa. Doors open at 6:30. The full fall lineup can be found at grassrootsconcerts.org. Slight chance of showers this evening, then cloudy, lows in the low 40s. Tomorrow, mix of clouds and sun with highs in the mid to upper 50s. Lows tomorrow night in the 40s and a chance of rain. And for Thursday, showers are likely, highs 59 to 67. KAXE is bringing you a brand new podcast. It debuts this Thursday. KAXE's Season Watch Pod has hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. It's a podcast for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. Watermark Art Center hosts a Story Slam Thursday, October 16th at Bemidji Brewing. Music starts at 6, stories at 7. This month's theme is Scared Stupid. Stories should be 5 minutes or less. Find more information at watermarkartcenter.org. Happy Dancing Turtles Fall Bingo Scavenger Hunt is going on now through October 31st. Look for items on your bingo card and submit photos online. Learn more and register at happydancingturtle.org.
PR comes from this station and from 20th Century Studios with Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, a pivotal chapter in the life of an icon, starring Jeremy Allen White and Jeremy Strong in theaters October 24th. Tickets available now. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Nadworny.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. If you, like me, are a Harlan Coben fan, you're in good company. Just about everything he writes ends up on the bestseller lists. He's got 90 million books in print worldwide. But even Harlan stopped in his tracks when he got a call one day asking if he wanted to collaborate.
It sounds so braggy for me to say, well, Reese Witherspoon called and said she wanted to meet about an idea. And I was just a little wary. I'm not necessarily the guy who collaborates on novels. You know, novel is a very solitary activity, and it's, you know, where I spend most of my life alone.
You haven't collaborated on one before, is that right?
Never with a novel.
Well, collaborate they did. Harlan Coben and the actress and producer Reese Witherspoon have just published a thriller. It's called Gone Before Goodbye. I asked them to tell me how they did it.
Our process was, we would meet in person probably every other week for a few hours at his apartment and just talk about teasing it all out. And then Harlan would write and he would send me chapters and I would go back in and say, well, I don't think she'd say it like this. I think she'd say it like that. Or, this is amazing. Keep going. So it was a lot of texting. I love to do research too. So I was always sending him articles about artificial hearts being made out of a pig heart or CEOs of companies being, I don't even know. I was just sending him all kinds of stuff.
Like dense reading material, and then Harlan is your job. Okay, but how do I do a cliffhanger of a chapter ending out of this?
Yeah, but it was a lot of discussion. At the end of the day, it's like there's an old Yiddish expression that you can't ride two horses with one behind. So I sort of said to Reese in the beginning, like only one hand can actually be on the keyboard at a time. And they should be mine just because, you know, I've done that part before. And so, you know, I sent her things constantly. She would comment back. We would discuss it. And we were both obsessed with it.
Okay, so let's apply all this to the main character. This is a woman. It's a surgeon. Her name is Maggie. Maggie McCabe. Reese, what else should we know about her?
Maggie, gosh. Maggie was, for me, a character as vivid and real as any character I've ever played in a movie. She was a military surgeon, and when you start the novel, she's lost her medical license. She's really down on her luck. She's deeply in debt. You kind of don't know why, but you're going to find out. And I wanted to set her up in a way that we understood that she was extremely good at what she did, but she was really down on her luck.
Yeah.
It starts off in a way that I think you understand why she decides to take on this unbelievable once-in-a-lifetime offer to go to Russia and perform a surgery on a high-net-worth person who she has no understanding of what it would entail and what is about to happen to her.
She's an appealing character to me. She's really tough, as you learn early on. She's also very feminine. Reese, read me. There are a few lines that I was chuckling at. This is page 49. It's the few lines that begin with, she hangs up.
Oh, yeah. Okay. She hangs up and throws on black jeans, boots, a denim shirt, and a blazer. It's a massive mind melt that never seems to have a clear answer. Never be too provocative, but never be too stuffy. Oh, and have a sense of style and always know what's trending so you don't appear, gasp, out of date. Always trying to find the right balance between feminine and practical. Utterly exhausting.
I'm laughing. I'm also thinking, preach. Am I right in detecting maybe you wrote that part, that only a woman could have written that?
That was part of it. Harlan was like, I need you to write this.
I'm like, what is she wearing? What is she wearing here, Reese?
But help, he said, out. What is she wearing? And for me, it's like, here's the constant mental math that women are doing every day of their lives. To be considered professional, but not to be too sexualized. And then, are you age appropriate? And also, she's a woman who's very serious about her job and is frequently in places where she's underestimated. So it's a full exploration into what is it like to have to just get up and get dressed as a woman, whereas guys just put on their pants and their shirts.
Yeah, exactly. That scene for the guy would have been khakis and a white button down. Next, my favorite character, much as I loved Maggie, was Porkchop. Harlan, tell us about Porkchop. Spelled like the cut of meat, by the way.
Yeah, it's
Porkchop is his
Porkchop
name.
Porkchop is Maggie's father-in-law, who is sort of a biker dude with a very modern attitude about that whole thing and is sort of both zen and tough and dark. And I think that Reese and I had a blast sort of creating him. You know, it's funny, when you're working with someone like Reese Witherspoon, who knows so much about both story and acting, there was times we would be in the room and I could almost tell she was turning into Maggie a little bit. And I would kind of be like, ooh, Maggie's in the room with me right now. This is a chance for me to get some good information. Mm-hmm. And we really wanted her to have this kind of banter and relationship that would bring out a lot about her with somebody. And Porkchop ended up being that perfect guy. I actually compare him sometimes to Jennifer Coolidge in Legally Blonde. Just someone stealing scenes away when at will, kind of a thing.
Well, he keeps roaring in on a motorcycle, and he's got a crazy, speaking of clothes, he's got some crazy wardrobe choices, so there's that.
Yeah, I think those were more mine, but yeah.
So you two, obviously, between you and in different ways, have done so much to support books and writers and reading over the years. I mean, Harlan, we nodded to your 90 million in print and counting, and Reese's book club, which a lot of people may be familiar with. My question to each of you, does reading, do books feel more important than ever in a moment when our country is so divided over so many things, but we can all come together and we still love a good story?
I mean, absolutely. I think reading has never been more important. In many ways. First of all, there's been now scientific studies that show that if you read a book at night rather than scrolling on your phone, if you just read 5 minutes a day, it improves your mental health, it helps you sleep, it gives you clarity. Telling stories like this, reading a novel, we all know this is good for us. And we all know it gives us empathy, which can help all sides. And it is some place where we can all go together. Well, we talk a lot about this book. I think Reese and I also want this book to be that book. You know, we want Gone Before Goodbye to be that book you take to bed at 11 o'clock at night. Say, I'm only going to read for 10 minutes, and it's 4 or 5 in the morning, and you've just had to keep reading to find out what happened to Maggie and Porkchop and the rest, and you're deliriously happy.
I mean, I guess the flip side, Reese, does writing fiction, did it ever feel beside the point on mornings when you wake up and the world feels like a dumpster fire?
No, I think it's more important than ever, just to echo what Harlan said. I'll add on that I think book clubs are really important.
Yeah.
Actually sitting together in a common space and socializing ideas and talking them out and saying, I've had this experience that was inside this book. Have you? And I think in this world of disconnection, there's nothing more important than connecting and talking about what are your personal opinions. And literature facilitates those conversations.
Yeah. That's Reese Witherspoon and Harlan Coben talking about the new novel they have co-authored, Gone Before Goodbye. Reese, Harlan, thank you.
Thank you
Thanks
so
very much.
Much.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 529. In just a few moments, the Up North Report, local news from our region. We have a slight chance of showers this evening, then cloudy, lows in the low 40s, a mix of clouds and sun tomorrow with highs in the upper 50s, and southeast winds 5 to 10. Looking ahead to Thursday, showers likely, highs 59 to 67. Coming up at 7 o'clock, John Henningsgaard, your volunteer host for On the River. Right now, the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. A Hibbing man is in critical condition after his home exploded Sunday evening. The Hibbing Fire Department responded to the incident on 9th Avenue East just before 7 p.m. and found the home engulfed in flames. Dave Peterson was transported to Fairview Range Medical Center in Hibbing for treatment and is now fighting for his life at the Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis. A GoFundMe started by his family says Peterson lived in the home with his wife Missy and four-year-old grandson. The explosion leveled the home and the fire spread to a house next door, causing extensive damage, according to friends of the Northland Firewire. The cause of the explosion is under investigation. Firefighters continue to strengthen containment lines and address hotspots in the wildfire burning in George H. Crosby Manitou State Park. Officials announced Saturday that the fire was caused by a lightning strike. The Crosby Fire has grown to 300 acres since it began last Wednesday. Its size has remained steady since Sunday. Crews have established lines around 85% of the fire as of Tuesday morning. Favorable weather has assisted firefighting efforts, with rain expected Wednesday night. Tenants in Bemidji are banding together to form an alliance in a city that largely rents. Larissa Donovan attended their first meeting and has more.
Bemidji's need for more affordable housing has dominated local studies and surveys for years, with the Headwaters Regional Development Commission releasing a comprehensive housing study last month. The study confirmed what is anecdotally known across nonprofits and government groups. The community has a high poverty rate and aging housing stock. The study also found that while 70% of Beltrami County's residents own their home, that statistic is nearly reversed for the county seat of Bemidji, around 60% of the residents rent. These factors played a role in 24-year-old Brady Crosby forming what is, for now, called the Bemidji Tenants Union.
We're now a majority renter community. Another thing is I just think there's a lack of accountability. There's only one seat at the table right now, and that's just for the landlords.
During the initial meeting Thursday, Crosby and co-founder Reed Olson described the next steps for the group, including a possible name change and forming a nonprofit. The group is anticipated to begin selecting members for its board of directors at its next meeting, slated for 5:30 p.m. Wednesday, November 12th at the Bemidji Public Library. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension ordered law enforcement agencies across the state to suspend using the Data Master breathalyzer test until the machines were inspected. The requirement Friday follows the discovery of multiple data entry errors related to the dry gas cylinders used in the machines, according to a news release. This follows reporting by the Minnesota Star Tribune that found that hundreds of tests may have been compromised due to the error, including in Aiken County. In a Monday press conference, BCA Superintendent Drew Evans says the action was out of an abundance of caution.
This is a bit nuanced and technical. It doesn't necessarily mean, even if there were errors, that the test results themselves were not reliable.
One driving while intoxicated case in Aiken County was dismissed, and others may be challenged due to the error. On the heels of the Trump administration laying off federal workers during the government shutdown, some state workers in Minnesota watch with worry. The budget stalemate in Washington is trickling down to the state level in situations where a state office gets federal funding to carry out a certain function. That includes workers who look over applications for disability claims covered by Social Security. Lisa Becker reviews these claims for the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. She points out that a temporary layoff layoff for her would be devastating to the clients she assists.
How long is that going to delay decisions for people who need answers for their physical and mental health care needs?
Becker says even if she were laid off for a day or two, pending benefit claims would likely be pushed back longer due to scheduling conflicts for doctor's exams. State officials say available federal funds will prevent staffing disruptions for this service until October 27th. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at Progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Alyssa Nadworny. The government shutdown is affecting federal workers and the cities they live in far beyond Washington, D.C. In Ogden, Utah, the Treasury Department is the biggest employer, with more than 7,000 employees there, mostly at a big IRS service center. That agency has furloughed almost half its employees across the country and laid off just under 1,500. Macy Lipkin of member station KUER reports.
October is in full swing on 25th Street in Ogden, about 45 minutes north of Salt Lake City. Decorative gravestones are planted in the window of a pizza shop. Banners on a street lamp advertise the Harvest Moon Festival and Day of the Dead event. Susie Zenger runs a bakery and sandwich shop near the IRS offices with her husband. Walking in feels like entering a nice warm oven. The counter is covered in cinnamon rolls and pumpkin muffins.
We're not used to being this slow. We're sending employees home early because they get their everything done, and so they're losing hours.
The Treasury, including the IRS, is Ogden's largest employer. Zenger says they get a lot of federal workers as customers. They've gotten to know some regulars. And for the past few weeks, she's been wondering where some of them went.
Well, something was in the air and people were hesitant to come and spend or, you know, treat themselves to lunch.
Dan Martinez is an 18-year veteran at the IRS. He spoke as the legislative coordinator for the local chapter of the Treasury Workers Union. We met after the CrossFit class he coaches on the side.
These are not millionaires and, you know, that are making money off of the government. These are folks that have taken a duty to serve the American people, have taken that oath of office.
He says the talk of DOGE cuts around the beginning of the year put a lot of his coworkers on edge. The union chapter's president says about 1,000 took deferred resignation at that time, and another 400 or 500 probationary employees were dismissed before a court reversed that move. All that uncertainty, Martinez says, has made remaining employees more careful with their spending.
All the rhetoric that federal employees were bad, we've been through that now. There's definitely a hold it close to the vest kind of thing where we have to worry about our savings.
Now that he and others have been furloughed, he's heard of coworkers offering advice on how to apply for unemployment or borrow from a 401k. Some are inviting others over for dinner.
And that's one of the things that's hopeful from, you know, that this shutdown is seeing the way people rally around each other.
Martinez says IRS jobs come with a sense of pride and duty. It's not uncommon for multiple family members to work there. He says it's not okay for federal workers to be used as political pawns. At No Frills Diner, Ron Yates serves homemade comfort food. The booths are red. Photos of 1950s movie stars line the walls. He says nearby construction has made it hard for customers to find parking lately.
Everybody's worried. It's not just the government shutdown. The economy is just horrible. People couldn't afford to live anyway.
Yates says his diner is his life. He's here every hour it's open. He has been for 17 years. And he feels stuck because he doesn't want to raise prices and wind up turning people away.
I sometimes feel like everything I've worked for is just going to disappear.
He was looking forward to the holiday season.
But now with all this shutdown and furlough, and now I don't know what's going to happen to the holidays.
And that, he says, is really concerning. For NPR News, I'm Macy Lipkin in Ogden, Utah.
After Charlie Kirk was assassinated, some people mobilized on social media to get critics of the conservative activist fired. That effort even got an endorsement from Vice President J.D. Vance. While the firing campaign has since ebbed, those who were targeted are still grappling with what happened. NPR's Huo Jingnan spoke to one of them.
Alexandra said she was horrified by Kirk's killing.
I felt as bad for him as I feel for any victim of gun violence, especially in schools.
But she's also no fan of Kirk. NPR is only identifying Alexandra by her middle name because she's concerned about her safety.
It definitely angered me that everybody was making him to be a martyr for free speech and some kind of hero.
So she wrote a post on Facebook
about how he reacted to the Pelosi attack.
Ahead of the 2022 midterms, a man broke into the home of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. He attacked Pelosi's husband Paul with a hammer and fractured his skull. Days after the attack, which Kirk called awful, here's what he said about the attacker on his podcast.
And why is he still in jail? Why has he not been bailed out? By the way, if some amazing patriot out there in San Francisco or the Bay Area wants to really be a midterm hero, someone should go and bail this guy out.
Alexandra's post mimicked Kirk's words. It read in part, if some amazing patriot out there in Utah wants to be a midterm hero, someone should go and bail out Tyler Robinson. That's the man who's accused of killing Kirk. Her post makes some people angry.
I argue with people on the internet for fun. That's really, or mental disease. But either way, yeah, I'm definitely like Charlie Kirk in that I like to incite debate.
But this time, some people passed her post along to a high-profile account on X that was flagging anti-Kirk posts. Alexandra says the moment she saw the X post, which named her employer, she knew she was going to get fired.
You log into Twitter and you see 500,000 people following a page, including Elon Musk. And, you know, they're saying you better fire this person or we're going to cancel all of our contracts.
3 hours later, she lost her job.
Just an email that says you've been fired effective immediately, and that's it.
While the post flagging Alexandra's words didn't go viral, it didn't need to in this environment, says Daniel Trottier. He's a professor at Erasmus University Rotterdam who has studied online naming and shaming campaigns. He says Alexandra's employer may have worried about the even more prominent voices, such as Musk, the post could potentially draw.
But I think it's a sort of escalation of recognizing how these cases can go out of hand, and especially in the current political context, not wanting to be scrutinized in such a way.
He says with the engagement-seeking nature of social media, the idea of a proportionate response to posts like these has gone out the window. The X account that targeted Alexandra also flagged at least 150 people in the days after Kirk was killed. No one associated with the account responded to NPR's request for comment. Alexandra hasn't moved on from what happened. Some of the comments she received scared her.
Some random person was like, hey, how's, you know, XYZ restaurant? And it happens to be a block away from my house.
Not long after, she grabbed some clothes, left her apartment in New York City, and went to a friend's place.
So I woke up in her kid's princess room in the morning, and then I went to another friend's house in Connecticut for the next 3 or 4 days.
She has since returned home, but things have not felt the same.
There was a guy standing on the roof across the street from my house. And normally, there's not usually people there. And normally it wouldn't really faze me, but I lowered my shades.
This especially hits home for Alexandra, who was born in the former Soviet Union. She says her family left so she could grow up with more freedoms in America. She understands that her employer could fire her for any reason, but she also wonders what the campaign to fire some of Kirk's critics means for freedom of expression.
Where does this stop? What if I went to a protest? And what if I made a sign that somebody took a picture of and they didn't like?
For the time being, Alexandra is trying to get the X post about her taken down, with no success so far. Huo Jingnan, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We now turn to Maine, where a key U.S. Senate race is already heating up more than a year before next year's midterm election. Today, the state's Democratic Governor Janet Mills announced she's entering the contest to defeat Republican Senator Susan Collins. Here she is in an announcement video.
I won't sit idly by while Maine people suffer and politicians like Susan Collins bend a knee as if this were normal. My life's work has prepared me for this fight, and I'm ready to win.
Mills was a top recruit for Senate Democratic leaders, who believe she's their best chance to defeat Collins and help them regain the majority. But her candidacy also comes as progressive Democrats are mounting insurgent campaigns that could lead to difficult primary contests. Steve Missler from member station Maine Public has been covering this, and he joins us now. Hi, Steve.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Can you start by telling us a little bit about Governor Mills and why she decided to run?
Sure. Well, Mills is toward the end of her final term and remains relatively popular. She'll be 78 in December, so the idea that she would want to enter a grueling race against Collins seemed pretty far-fetched when the speculation about her candidacy began. And that really happened after she attended a conference at the White House in February. There, she was confronted by President Trump over transgender athletes, and he essentially demanded that that Maine comply with his executive order, banning them from participating on girls' sports teams.
Your population doesn't want men playing in women's sports, so you better comply because otherwise you're not getting any federal funding.
See you in court.
Every state, good, I'll see you in court. I look forward to that. That should be a real easy one.
And that exchange really put Mills in the national spotlight, right?
Yeah, that's right. The governor suddenly became this sort of resistance hero for Democrats. And that's one of the reasons why the confrontation was featured so prominently in the governor's announcement video. And in Mills' telling, it crystallized this need to get in the race against Collins, who she says hasn't done enough to fight Trump.
Now, before Mills even gets a shot at Collins, she's going to have to get through what is now a pretty crowded Democratic field. That could expose some intra-party tensions. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we're seeing this trend in several states where working-class populists are launching bids for Congress and sometimes challenging candidates who are recruited by Democratic leaders. And that's especially true in Maine, where political newcomer Graham Plattner, a military veteran and oyster farmer, has made a big splash since entering the race in August. He was recruited by labor activists and quickly endorsed by Senator Bernie Sanders, who gave him a prime speaking spot at a Labor Day rally in Portland. And he's really tried to channel this anger in the Democratic base, not just at Trump or Republicans, but also party leaders.
We have two parties that want the votes of working people, but neither has done anything lately to earn it.
So Platt has tried to frame Mills as sort of a proxy for what he describes as establishment Democrats just being out of touch with what voters want.
And just to be clear, Senator Collins hasn't officially announced that she's seeking re-election, but she would be seeking her sixth term if she does, right?
Correct. And by all indications, Collins looks ready to run. She's also a tough campaigner. She's beaten back every challenger Democrats have thrown at her, including in 2020, when they helped break a state record for spending in a Senate race, only to then lose by more than 8 points. So it'll be a tough race for whichever candidate emerges as the pick for Dems.
Steve Missler from member station Maine Public. Thank you, Steve.
My pleasure.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. Good evening. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, the debate on synthetic biology. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. We'll also sample our album of the week. 7 o'clock, John Henningsgaard will bring you a great mix of music on the river. Support comes from the Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscapes, and people of Lake Country. The February-March issue publishes the winners of their annual photo contest, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com. We have a slight chance of showers this evening, then cloudy, lows in the low 40s. For Wednesday, a mix of clouds and sun with highs in the mid to upper 50s. Lows tomorrow night in the 40s, chance of rain, and for Thursday, showers likely, highs 59 to 67. Plans are underway for the 20th annual Back to Basics event, February 7th at Pine River Bacchus School. They are looking for presenters and vendors who are passionate about sustainable living. Proposals are due November 14th. Find more information at happydancingturtle.org. And there is an Indigenous and Community Health Fair Tuesday, October 21st, noon to 5 at the Armory Arts and Event Center in Park Rapids. Find community health resources and participate in Indigenous traditions like dancing, drumming, and beading. And Northern Exposure to Lifelong Learning welcomes Doug Oman at the Bagley American Legion tomorrow at 9:30. Oman will talk about the Barns of Minnesota. Let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. There is more ahead from All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE. Thanks for listening.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Nadworny.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Later this week, a group you have probably never heard of will weigh in on an almost existential question. How far should we go to save a species from extinction? At issue is the use of something called synthetic biology and how or even if it should be used to preserve the natural world. NPR's Nate Rott reports.
Synthetic biology is kind of a catch-all term for an emerging field of science, but for our purposes, think of it as a suite of genetic tools that can be used to modify species. Like, for example, making corals more resilient to heat, plants hardier to endure drought, or in Anthony Waddell's case, frogs more resilient to horrendous diseases like chytrid fungus, a skin disease that effectively suffocates frogs from the outside.
It's considered the worst pandemic ever, the worst invasive species ever in terms of biodiversity loss.
Waddell is a conservation biologist at Macquarie University in Australia.
It's the entire tree of life of amphibians that's being impacted.
Waddell was born in Las Vegas and started working with frogs there. His initial focus was on a desert frog dealing with chytrid.
That work was like classic conservation, you know, bringing eggs in from the remaining populations, raising them up, putting them at new sites, augmenting existing sites, surveys, really like your bread and butter conservation.
And he says it worked really well for that species. They were kept off of the endangered species list. But he says these frogs were almost an exception to the rule. And as he moved to Australia, working with other researchers to help more types of frogs.
I'm being approached by people that are watching species and populations go extinct and they're desperate for solutions. Something that makes the species resilient to the future challenges they're going to face.
Which brought him to synthetic biology and the hope that there might be a way to genetically modify at-risk frogs using snippets of DNA from other frogs that already have immunity to the disease.
I see this as the new frontier for conservation. This is our moon landing. You know, we can modernize our entire field, bring it into the 21st century.
Using DNA that already exists in nature as part of the broader solution. The thing is, synthetic biology and the idea of releasing genetically modified species into the wild is hugely controversial. So controversial that this week the World Conservation Congress, a once every 4 years gathering of the world's top nature conservationists, scientists, and decision makers, will vote on a proposed moratorium. A moratorium that would pause the release of genetically modified species into the wild. Ricarda Steinbrecher is a European biologist and molecular geneticist attending the ongoing meeting in Abu Dhabi.
In a way, a moratorium, I think, is a wise tool to say, like, okay, this is developing fast. There's a real push for release, but the outcomes of it are highly risky. And we don't even know whether this stuff will work.
The main risk Steinbrecher sees, and there are many, is that once a genetically modified species is released in the wild, it's hard to say what will happen. Will it really work? How will it evolve? What if the changes, however well-intentioned, have unforeseen consequences? And how would you stop them if they become part of the wild?
Not everything one thinks should happen actually works according to the models one has in one's head.
Steinbrecher says there are many examples in human history where well-intentioned interventions in nature have gone awry.
Like if you put a rabbit into an area like Australia, we know what happened, that it became a very invasive species and big problems. Nobody expected that.
There's a tendency to react to new technology with fear.
Sue Lieberman is the vice president of international policy with the New York-based Wildlife Conservation Society.
You know how they say close the barn door after the horse bolted? This would be closing it after the horse is 100 miles away. You're calling for a moratorium on something that's already out there.
She points to ongoing work releasing genetically modified mosquitoes to slow malaria as an example.
I'm not saying everything that might be done using synthetic biology is all wonderful and we don't need to be careful. We need to be careful, yes.
But she thinks a moratorium is a step too far. Now, the international body voting this week, which includes governments and nonprofits, has no regulatory authority. Its decisions are non-binding. But it does carry a lot of respect. And
everybody cares about reputation.
Ryan Phelan is the co-founder and executive director of the nonprofit Revive and Restore, which provides funding for synthetic biology research.
It's hard to find funding for innovation. And it's even hard for researchers to get permission to do research.
Even in their own institutions, if that research is viewed as controversial. And with more than a million species facing extinction within decades, the ever-growing threats of climate change and habitat loss, Phelan says now is not the time to pump the brakes on research.
We just don't have time. I mean, there are 1,500 or some reef-building corals worldwide, and we've already lost probably hundreds of species that we don't even know what they are. They're gone.
Advocates for the moratorium, like Steinbrecher, who we heard from earlier, agree that there's urgency.
But we have to act wisely.
Earlier, I said Steinbrecher is skeptical of synthetic biology for a lot of reasons. Maybe the most philosophical of them is this.
One needs to consider here that the use of genetic engineering in conservation basically represents a paradigm shift, you know, from safeguarding nature for its intrinsic value to redesigning it to fit human preferences in a way.
Many of the researchers using synthetic biology would argue they're using it not for human preference, but to safeguard nature. But Steinbrecher's broader point and concern is that it could fundamentally change our relationship with the natural world.
Will we then still, if we started modifying everything, still have the same care to look after it? Or what has it become then?
Will we still view nature as nature? Anthony Waddle, the scientist looking to save frogs, agrees these are huge questions. He agrees they can be scary. But he doesn't think it's fair to view the natural world and wildlife as some kind of intact, immaculate thing. Humans have already changed so many ecosystems and species.
Look at every domestic animal ever. Dogs are a great example. Like, a chihuahua is the same species as a wolf. That's a bigger sin against nature than doing one little gene change. Like, I think people need to acknowledge that we already impact nature in a profound way. And we have the capacity to use it for good for once. And maybe we should just consider it.
Regardless of the outcome of this week's vote, there's a couple of things that both sides of this debate agree on. That action is desperately needed to protect nature. And that people, like you and me, need to consider these questions. Because extinction isn't going to stop. And moratorium or not, the question of how far we should go to save a species isn't going away. Nate Rott, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One, offering their dining and entertainment card, Saver. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Odoo, maker of business management software with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com.
From Subaru. Subaru has donated more than $70 million to support the adoption, rescue, transport, and health of over 700,000 animals. Learn more at Subaru.com/pets. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXC.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you for your support. I'm Jennifer Barg. Up ahead, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. 7 o'clock, John Henningsgaard, your volunteer host for On the River. We have a chance of showers this evening, then cloudy, lows in the low 40s. And for tomorrow, a mix of clouds and sun, highs in the mid to upper 50s, lows tomorrow night in the 40s, chance of rain and